15, I get that. Should I wait there, I guess?
Good afternoon. Welcome to the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development for Wednesday, April 3rd. Want to announce at the start, for anyone who might be waiting, House Bill 2067 is not ready. We're going to carry that over to the Friday agenda. And so anyone who's waiting for that, please be aware. We'll start with a public hearing on House Bill 3450. Try to give us a summary, please.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. House Bill 3450 establishes James Beard Public Market Project within Oregon Business Development Department to award grants, make loans, and provide other financial assistance for James Beard Public Market. Establishes James Beard Public Market Fund, continuously appropriates monies in fund to department for purpose of project, appropriates money from general fund to department to establish and implement project, declares emergency effective upon passage.
Thank you. Representative Williamson, if you'd like to start us, and please feel free to bring anyone with you whom you'd like.
Thank you, Chair Reed, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jennifer Williamson. I am the state representative from House District 36, which is Portland's west side. Thank you for having this hearing today. I'm very excited to be here to tell you a little bit about James Beard Public Market, really what will become Oregon's market. Our state is rightfully known for the quality and integrity of our agricultural bounty. Since its founding, Portland has been the state center for agricultural commerce. Some of the finest public markets in the country served the state from 1870 until 1941, when the last public market, the last true public market in Portland and in Oregon closed. The James Beard Public Market is named after Oregon's very own food legend, James Beard. He was born in Portland, where his mother ran the Gladstone Hotel and his father worked at the city's custom house. The Beard family vacationed on the coast in Gearhart, and there Beard was exposed to Oregon's bounty. According to Beard's memoir, his earliest food memory was the Lewis and Clark expedition of 1905, when he was 2 years old. He recalled, "I was taken to the expedition two or three times, and the thing that remained in my mind above all others, I think it marked my life, was watching Triscuits and shredded wheat, biscuits being made. Isn't that crazy? At 2 years old, that memory was made, and it intrigued the hell out of me." James Beard frequented the street markets in Portland at his mother's side and learned the magic of cooking with local ingredients, a philosophy that would define his career and lead him to become the dean of American cooking. He was America's first TV chef, even before Julia. Now the James Beard Awards are the Oscars and Emmys of the food world, and his name is synonymous with celebrating the regional bounty of wherever you are. He was a proud Oregonian and had a head start on knowing great food. The James Beard Public Market will honor his roots and provide a living legacy through his contributions to Oregon's food culture, one that the national media consistently recognizes. As Oregonians, we know our locally produced food and drink are among the state's most valuable treasures and biggest economic drivers. The James Beard Public Market is a great opportunity to provide small businesses a year-round showcase for their products. This daily indoor-outdoor marketplace will represent the state's farms, orchards, vineyards, breweries, fisheries, and ranches, strengthening Oregon's rising culinary reputation and economy. James Beard Market is a smart investment that aligns with our state's priorities of locally focused development, economic stability, sustainability, and environmental conservation. And I urge your support for this project.
Thank you. Mr. Paul.
Chair Reed and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ron Paul. I'm the executive director of the James Beard Public Market. Thank you for hearing House Bill 3450. I have been involved in Oregon's food industry for over 35 years as a chef and restaurateur on the early wave of discovering the local bounty of Oregon agriculture. After 15 years helming my own restaurants, Ron Paul Charcuterie, including being the first Oregon chef invited to cook at the James Beard House in New York, I entered the political realm as then Commissioner Commissioner Charlie Hales as Chief of Staff, and later as the Food Policy Manager for Portland's Office of Sustainable Development. For the past 7 years, while serving as Consulting Director for the James Beard Public Market, I have advised businesses and governments on food systems projects throughout the West. Since 2000, a group of diverse and dedicated community volunteers has studied, analyzed, and pursued the vision of creating a vibrant public market. This included farmers, architects, food writers, chefs, hunger relief activists, farmers markets, board and staff members, and others interested in creating a vibrant central market. Their work led to the creation of the Historic Portland Public Market Foundation in 2003, a 501c3 nonprofit that was granted tax-exempt status in 2005. Many of those volunteers continued as board members, including City Commissioner Dan Saltzman, now Mayor Charlie Hales, Finance Advisor Dave Chen, Chef Greg Higgins, retired farmer Marcus Samantle, Deborah Kane, and Wendy Lane, a principal in the PR firm, and former Central City Concern and the state's former mental health director, Richard Harris, who is in the audience with us today. In 2008, the Markets Board successfully negotiated the exclusive and perpetual rights with the New York-based James Beard Foundation. From 2008 to 2011, the Markets Board worked tirelessly to secure a permanent site. In partnership with Melvin Mark Development Company, the market prevailed in Multnomah County's request for proposals to purchase the West Morrison Bridgehead site in downtown Portland. The final agreement, signed only last December, allows the market 3 years to complete planning and to raise the necessary funds to construct the market without long-term debt obligations that would be serviced by the merchant vendors. Having nonprofit status without dividends to shareholders and ensuring that the market opens debt-free will allow the most diverse group of vendors to compete on a level basis. This is how successful public markets ensure that rents are stable and realistic, especially for ethnic and immigrant entrepreneurs. This is a key factor to ensure improved equity and access to healthy local foods through a diverse vendor and, in turn, shopping base. Improving the performance of Oregon-owned food and agriculture businesses is the principal reason for creating the James Beard Public Market. Eco Northwest estimated an increase of at least $22 million in annual food sales at margins that are superior to those selling through commodity exchanges, and at least 247 new jobs created within the market. Even more important are the more than 101 jobs in the state's rural areas in support of these increased sales. Without even using a standard multiplier for the economic impact, it's clear that the market will have a significant role in the state's food economy. Let me digress from my written testimony for 1 minute to talk about the amount of local food that stays in the metro area and is consumed. It's estimated at approximately 5 to 10%. Katie Kobo will testify in just a few minutes on the strength of Oregon agriculture as an export part of our economy, but equally as important is substituting the imports for having local food instead of sending Oregon dollars to California and elsewhere. Right now, current estimates are between 5 and 10% of Oregon-produced food is consumed in Oregon. For every 1% we move that dial, it has a $40 million impact on the local economy. For every 1% we move that dial, It has a $40 million impact on the local economy. The public market is designed specifically to be able to raise that bar for more people enjoying more local food that's produced throughout the state. Education and public health are other key elements in the market's design. Planning is underway for a comprehensive program to bring children and grandparents together in an education kitchen to learn the history of where their food comes from and their culturally appropriate food ways that now border on extinction. The nation's fast food culture has exacted a toll on public health in many ways, and the James Beard Public Market understands the critical role it will play in countering that trend. During the past decade, the market successfully raised private funding from individuals, corporations, foundations, and the federal departments of agriculture and housing and urban development, among others. In addition, the market has been the beneficiary of tens of thousands of dollars in pro bono architectural, engineering, legal, accounting, and other professional services. This bill will contribute to the funding for the next essential steps in the market's development. Since so few markets have been built in North America during the past century, there is no reliable formula for determining the square foot cost. The market must have accurate schematic design and preliminary engineering that will allow for realistic cost estimates. Without these essential tools, robust private fundraising cannot proceed at the pace necessary to meet our deadline. Thank you for your time and attention. I look forward to answering any questions you may have.
I expect we will. Thank you very much. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't expect to be the first to ask a question. I definitely understand the principles involved in replacing money spent on out-of-state products within state. I definitely understand the multiplier. I've been doing this kind of stuff for a lot of years. What I need to be convinced of is that the jobs that are being created are not just moving jobs around. For example, jobs in the market, would those be replacing jobs that were in other retail establishments, for example, or in other private entrepreneurial activities? Are we really increasing the number of people traveling to Oregon and to this market to the extent that there are 250 employees more working in Oregon than would have otherwise? That's one of the key things that is really hard for me to get to that
right
point.
Very good question, Representative. Let me divide those into rural and urban. The rural jobs would be almost entirely new since we're increasing the production of local agriculture that's dedicated to increased sales within the market. Those same agricultural workers and firms would not necessarily be selling to a Costco, a Walmart, a Safeway, and so it's scaled for that segment. So you can rest very comfortably about the rural jobs. The urban jobs, undoubtedly there would be some replacement. Todd Davidson from Travel Oregon will appear shortly at this desk to talk about the opportunities for tourism that the market would generate. And so we also know that because of the location, the density of office workers in the downtown Portland area, that they'll be buying more food within that environment as opposed to a Chipotle's or a McDonald's or others. Yes, you might be trading some jobs there. We would certainly allow, but we have the opportunity to keep those funds within Oregon's economy.
That's enough for now. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Will the market be providing space for food production for operations that actually sell food at lunchtime, prepared foods?
Yes. There will be prepared foods, bakeries, cafes, restaurants, even food carts, in addition to the fresh foods, the butchers, the grocers, the fishmongers, the cheesemongers.
So So would it be fair to say that we would be subsidizing those locations but by providing these dollars from state dollars versus the other locations that you previously mentioned would not get that same subsidy?
They would be local food businesses committed to using local ingredients. And so there would be an ecology within the market that would allow those merchants to have their own wholesale purchasing system. So if I were a baker making sandwiches, I could go to the neighborhood butcher within the market, and my neighboring butcher, get the ham, get the other ingredients. So the creation of the market is really an infrastructure type project that allows local entrepreneurs to be able to thrive in a very high traffic environment. If any of you are in the retail world, sales per square foot are a real key indicator. Public markets typically are in the $1,200 per square foot sales range. A Whole Foods is about $800. So what we're doing is compressing a tremendous amount of sales into a small area. And we're investing public and private dollars in a public-private partnership in order to create that environment, but one that's a level playing field for ethnic and immigrant merchants who, but for the public market, would not have a chance to be in a central city location.
Thank you.
Representative McCann.
Thank you, Chairman Reed. Could you explain to me a little bit more about the relationship between the private nonprofit, the market, and the Melvin Mark Company who's building the office building?
Yes. We are a 501c3 dedicated to creating the public market. We are not a development company that has the expertise to be able to actually build the project and know what we would be doing in the process. So about 5 years ago, we formed a working partnership with Melvin Mark Company to be our contract developer to build the market. They have an interest in the overall property, since there is a tower that would be adjacent to the market that they would have the rights to build. Multnomah County specifically in the development agreement with us said that Melvin Mark could be the developer if and only if they built the James Beard Public Market as part of the project.
Follow up,
please.
So the financial relationship is such that they have skin in the game, and it sounds like a significant amount?
A significant mm-hmm. amount.
Thank you.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. Could you clarify that? Are you saying that Melvin Mark's already required to build the market?
No, that we have a development agreement with Multnomah County.
Okay.
And the terms of the development agreement are the three-year deadline that I explained in my testimony. We have 3 years to raise the money, do the planning, and be ready to build the market, and then we close on the property at that time. So Melvin Mark would be our contract fee developer at that time. If the market doesn't happen for whatever reason, Melvin Mark would not be able to build the tower because Multnomah County's interest was in making sure that the public market happened.
Follow up,
please.
I still interpret that if Melvin Mark wants their building, they have to make sure the market's there. Is that correct?
Correct.
Thank you.
Follow up.
Follow up to someone else. Go ahead.
Like, what do you want to call
it? Another question, Representative.
Not round two, Chair Reed.
Go ahead.
So, what happens if Melvin Mark doesn't build their building?
We have talked about building the market and the high-rise in sequence. Our preference is to do them simultaneously, but it's a very valuable and iconic location that Melvin Mark is not a fly-by-night operation. They are a cold and calculating real estate firm and have every intention of following through on the commitments that they're making.
Mm-hmm. Follow-up, Chair Reed.
Please.
I guess those of us who have been in economic development for a long time, you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow or the next day.
Right.
And it's very possible that that world can change very rapidly, and I think all of us have experienced that in some phase. So if they end up not moving forward with their construction project, what's plan B?
Plan B is for the market to be able to build its part of the project. They're on separate lots. The goal is to condominiumize the property once it's built, and the market would have its own trajectory. There is value, though, for both the market and the high-rise in having them built simultaneously and connected.
One more follow-up, sir.
Go ahead.
So I guess what I'm trying to get at is how tightly are you wedded to them?
Very tightly. We have a memorandum of understanding of many years that is guiding our working together, and we're in the process of negotiating a follow-up to that, which is a pre-development agreement that then would lead to a development agreement when we're ready to start construction.
Thank you.
So I wonder if you could help us understand. The bill calls for $500,000 appropriation. I think you may have mentioned it in sort of broad terms in your testimony, but can you help us understand the rest of the finance plan? Who else is contributing to the broad picture?
The public-private partnership would be looking at the benefits of having especially the James Beard name to be able to help us raise private funds all over the country. There's a marquee value. So we are estimating that the total project is going to be in the $20 to $25 million range, including the price of the real estate. We don't know for sure that that's the number, and that's why...
That what is the number?
That the $20 to $25 million is the true cost of construction. We know that Multnomah County is charging $5.2 million for the real estate that the market sits on.
So the county is getting income from it. What are they contributing?
They are in a cash-poor position, like most governments, and are looking at a fair market value. And so they had a request for proposals process that Melvin Mark Company and the public market competed in and prevailed in, and the county was offering the property at its a value that they had an analyst determine for them, and we agreed to pay that price.
So the county is not contributing cash?
They are contributing access to the bridgehead in ways that make building the market possible. It's a very complicated deal because of the ramps and the structures that support the bridge, and we've worked very collaboratively with the county. They are certainly in support of this project and want to be able to leverage what they can. There are a couple of other parts to the project that are a little more technical. One is the building of a sky bridge.
I got to stop you. I think you're getting off a little track. Is the county contributing any cash?
They are not contributing cash at this time.
How about the city?
The city we are in discussions with since we just received the signed development agreement in December. We have not yet had the firm discussions with the city about how much they will support. Mayor Charlie Hales has submitted a letter in support, and he has pledged to work with us in all possible ways for city funding.
So if I'm understanding it, the bill asks for $500,000, no other public money at this point, unless I missed an entity for a project that you said we're not sure about the construction cost.
The public money has come in the past from the Portland Development Commission. It has come in the past from the Department of Agriculture and Housing and Urban Development. So this is not the first public money.
Okay, that's helpful. How much has come from those other sources?
About $250,000 in the aggregate.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Representative Lively.
So I apologize. I may have missed this, but I'm trying to understand the timeline here. You mentioned something about 3 years. So I'm trying to understand the importance because, again, coming from an economic development standpoint, when investments are made in often cases are critical to Kenan. So I'm just going to go back to the importance of this in relationship to leveraging other investments, or where does that all fit from a time standpoint?
The timing of this is very important to us. As you know from any economic development project, early money is the most valuable. We have private donors with whom we've been in discussion who are actively watching the trajectory of this bill and will likely calibrate some of their private gifts based on the momentum moving forward and the public support. Just like other economic development elements, the private fundraising is one of cultivation and a longer term process. But we do have significant indicators from private donors of their interest in supporting this. The city has been not only telegraphing their support, but we have unanimous support from our federal delegation across party lines in support of this, and they've pledged to work with us in a post-earmark environment to look for appropriate federal funding in addition to the private donors that we'll be cultivating.
So where's that date? So what's the date out there certain where something has to be in place in order for this, for you to feel comfortable that the project can move forward?
Yes. Approximately 38 months from today.
Okay. Thank you.
Questions?
One more. Just thank you, Cherry. Just to clarify, so this money is for planning, is that correct?
It's for schematic design and preliminary engineering.
Having been through these projects many, many times, I know how important that is.
Thank you, Representative.
It has to start somewhere. I understand that part.
Right. And it's not like building a traditional building where there's a formula for figuring out square foot costs.
Okay, I think that's all the questions we have for the two of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have a number of other people who want to testify as well. Ann Hannes, Katie Koba, Todd Davidson, please.
For the record, I'm Ann Hannes. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. Chair Reed and members of the committee, the Association of Oregon Counties supports House Bill 3450 in the development of the James Beard Public Market. We believe having a public market similar to Seattle's Pike Place Market or Vancouver's BC Granville Island Public Market will be a place where Oregon's bounty of agricultural products can be showcased, from Yamhill County wines to Malheur County beef to Willamette Valley berries and other products throughout Oregon. We also believe it's an outstanding small business incubator and can have statewide benefits to provide opportunities to market agricultural products from around the state. We've seen that food tourism is increasingly becoming a magnet for people from around the country and even around the world, and we believe this would even give more reason for people to visit the state. So we urge your support because this provides a venue for small farmers and others in Oregon to conveniently sell to restaurants, institutional markets, and the public, and to reap economic value for the state. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Director.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Katie Koba, Director of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. I get really excited when other people are saying such nice things about Oregon agriculture. So I don't often get a chance to be in front of your committee. Todd's going to say nice things next. But just briefly to kind of highlight for you, and I think many of you know this fact, Oregon agriculture is a very important part of Oregon's economy. Recent Oregon State University updates around our statistics show that agriculture represents about 15%, agriculture plus all the associated activities, so value-added, marketing, transportation, those kinds of things represents about 15% of Oregon's economy. It's one out of every 10 jobs. And as you heard earlier when Ron Paul was talking a little bit about agriculture, this industry is export dependent. There's no doubt about that. 80% of what we produce in our state leaves our state's borders, and half of that moves into an international market. That being said, the local market is also very, very important to Oregon agriculture. And I think one of the things that I've seen in particular over the last 5 years is just a huge explosion in the interest around food and where your food comes from and how it's grown, and great support, frankly, for Oregon farmers and ranchers. The challenge for some in the industry is finding outlets for those products. So if you're big enough and you can get into a Safeway or a Fred Meyer, and that's not to say that our retail stores have not been supportive of Oregon's farmers and ranchers, because they really have. But you still have to be on a scale to get into those markets. And so we in the department also work continually to figure out other venues for Oregon producers, particularly small producers, to have a chance to showcase their products. That's one of the reasons why the Department of Agriculture has been involved with the James Beard Public Market since early on. We serve on the board of the market. And we're excited, frankly, about the opportunities to provide yet one more venue for Oregon farmers and ranchers to showcase what they do. And also, we know that starting young in a place like this provides opportunity to grow and expand. So we have stories of producers that start in a farmer's market or in a small restaurant. They kind of hone their skills, start adding value to their product, process a product, and they will often expand into regional, domestic, and frankly, international markets. So we definitely see this as an economic development opportunity, a continued way to support Oregon agriculture. And frankly, I'd like to be able to have pride in a public market and not always have to say, that's a nice market up in Seattle, why don't we have one in Oregon? So thank you for your time and interest.
Thank you very much. Mr. Director.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Todd Davidson, and I have the privilege and pleasure of serving as the director of the Oregon Tourism Commission. You know, over the last decade, Travel Oregon has seen significant growth in our consumer contact and engagement with our marketing programs. We've seen responses grow by over 400% during that time period. We have nearly 1.6 million unique visitors on traveloregon.com each year, 130,000 Facebook fans, and 200,000 subscribers to our segmented e-newsletters. And we now have more potential travelers than ever before in this relationship network, as we call it at Travel Oregon. We're doing this by continuing to tie our advertising communications to what we call a focused two-pillar approach. In the fall, we're providing a culinary focus and position Oregon as that premier foodie destination. And we use a promotion called Oregon Bounty to anchor that portion of our campaign. We also then feature Oregon's outdoor recreational stories during our spring and summer advertising and marketing campaigns, when Oregon can deliver a wide array of outdoor adventure product. Our marketing efforts position Oregon as a place where it's still possible to have those authentic, personal encounters with the artisans who create Oregon's cuisine, its wine, its spirits, its craft brews, and other specialty products, while motivating overnight stays and day trips during the fall, as well as year-round foodie travel throughout the year, and capitalizing on the passions of these culinary enthusiasts who are seeking these unique culinary experiences with Oregon's array of artisanal products and local cuisine. Our most recent Oregon Bounty campaign told us that 52% of the folks that responded to our campaign told us that that campaign motivated them to travel to Oregon during the Oregon Bounty promotion. For those that chose not to travel to Oregon during the Oregon Bounty promotion, 62% of them said that the campaign has encouraged them and inspired them to travel to Oregon during other times of the year to partake in that Oregon culinary experience. Further to that point, We know through independent research that the Oregon Tourism Commission undertakes that for every $1.14 we invest in our media advertising programs, we're generating a new trip to Oregon where the consumer tells us we would not have traveled to Oregon were it not for the state's marketing efforts. Put another way, every dollar we're investing in our domestic media advertising campaign is generating $193 in new visitor spending and $8 in tax revenue, $5 at the state level in the form of corporate income tax, personal income tax, and fuel taxes, and $3 at the local level, primarily in the form of local lodging taxes. As you've heard said here this afternoon, the James Beard Public Market will operate a daily, year-round, indoor-outdoor venue that's going to showcase our region's bounty, provide that engaging food shopping and eating atmosphere, grow the Northwest economy by supporting regionally owned food-related businesses, and create an iconic market building with an energetic adjacent outdoor public space. That last point is especially important because I have long had a theory that for the Oregon Tourism Commission, if we were to invite folks to Oregon and they have an amazing vacation experience and they leave here feeling very satisfied with that vacation experience, we've only begun to tap into the potential of the travel and tourism industry. But if we can invite them to Oregon and when they return home, they're just a little bit changed, they're just a little bit more Oregonian, whether they're living in Miami or Munich or Manhattan, because they have an affinity for Oregon products now that they did not have before they came here, we've really begun to tap into the potential for the travel and tourism industry. So we undertook some research to find out if vacations in Oregon by leisure travelers actually changed their consumer behavior once they returned home. The first question we asked them was how satisfied they were with their vacation experiences, and 85% of our visitors said we were extremely or very satisfied with our vacation experience. Now, lest you believe that that means 15% were dissatisfied, 13.5% roughly were neutral. Why they were neutral, I do not know, but I feel a deep need to find out. Only 1.5% of our visitors said that they were dissatisfied with their Oregon vacation. Number one reason, weather. Number two, traffic. And number three, which any of us that are in marketing love, they were dissatisfied with their Oregon vacation because they said it was too short, which is a wonderful problem for us in destination marketing to have. So we started from that premise that they were feeling very or extremely satisfied. 43% of our visitors said they are now more or much more likely to purchase Oregon products than they were before their trip, and 31% said they had already purchased Oregon products several times since they returned home. That number actually increases to nearly 58% if you look at those that have bought a few times or several times. And this includes wines and microbrews and artisanal food products, our cheeses and chocolates and others. And 42% said that they're now going to be using these products to introduce their friends and relatives to Oregon. So at one time, our promotion may have been what introduced them to that product while they were here on a vacation, but now that product is being used and becoming the promotion. So in closing, I guess I would leave you with this thought, that while the James Beard Public Market stands to benefit from this positioning and awareness of Oregon as a vibrant culinary destination, they will amplify and enhance the experience our visitors will have in Oregon and expand opportunities to connect our visitors from around the world with amazing Oregon products. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Todd, maybe this you can help me with this one. There's some dollars required in this bill, and I'm just wondering about TOT tax and some other taxes that are collected in the city of Portland already for travel and tourism, and where those dollars are going. And we didn't hear from a previous witness about any of those dollars, because this is obviously about tourism and promoting tourism. Can you talk a little bit about how those funds possibly could be used?
Chair Reed, Representative Cameron, to some extent I believe I can, and I think if Mr. Paul were still up here, he would tell you that travel and tourism is a component of what they're wanting to accomplish with the James Beard Public Market, but certainly not the only facet to the James Beard Public Market. To that end, Portland's lodging tax does go to the promotion of the Oregon Convention Center, as well as the promotion of Portland as a leisure destination as well. They've recently passed a TID, which is a Tourism Improvement District, which is a something that was put in place by the lodging operators there with the, I guess I will say, the permission of the City Council there in Portland. And that will generate for them roughly, I think it's estimated to generate roughly $7 to $8 million per year that will just started being collected last fall. So that is new money to them. How all the lodging tax money in Portland is currently being spent and how that's allocated between general fund purposes and tourism purposes, I do not know. I don't have that information in front of me. I can certainly find out, and if the committee is interested, I can certainly provide that back to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you.
Sounds like we are interested in that.
All right. Thank you very much.
Good. Questions? Don't see any. We appreciate your time. Thank you. At least one person on the witness list. That's Jody Weiser. While Jody gets settled, if there's anyone else who wants to be heard on the bill, please let us know. Don't see anyone. So, Jody, you're the last person between us and the rest of our agenda.
Let's take 2 sentences. Last session we passed the Jody Weiser, tax credit organ, I'm sorry. Last session we passed the New Market Tax Credit Bill, and I believe there's still money available there, and the amount that would be available, I believe, would be about $1,500. So I think that this might be a good use of that, those funds.
Very good. Questions for Jody? I don't see any. Thank you very much. We appreciate it. And we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3450. Stand at ease for just a moment while Representative Gelser is on her way from next door to pick up the public hearing we began on Monday on House Bill 2428. So we will stand at ease for just a moment. Come back to order, and we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2428. And the committee will remember that we had this, we began this hearing on Monday. We talked about autonomous vehicles with a number of people, but notably, we did not have the sponsor of the bill. Fortunately, we do now. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Chair Reed, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state representative from House District 16, which includes Corvallis and Philomath. Thank you very much for holding this bill over, and I'm sorry that I could not be with you in person on Monday. It's perhaps fitting on a bill about autonomous vehicles and future technology that I was with you via the internet, so I had the opportunity to listen to your discussion and the testimony of the others that were there. So my My statements on this will be relatively brief because much was already said. House Bill 2428, I started working on over a year ago when it came out of my service on an organization called the National Council on Disability, which is a 15-member independent federal agency appointed by the President and confirmed by the U.S. Senate. One of my colleagues on the council is an individual from New Hampshire who's blind. And after the Mars rover landed, he turned to me and said, "Don't you think it's kind of strange that we can send this technology to another planet? It can move around and do all this scientific experimentation, and I can't drive myself to the corner store to get a quart of milk. Surely there's a way that we can take care of this." And that made me quite interested in the role that autonomous vehicle technology can play in addressing that longstanding need that we have for transportation for seniors and people with disabilities, in addition to all the other cool things that driverless cars might bring to us. So I contacted Google at that time, asked them how we might go about getting our statutes ready to have these cars on the road. Google had suggested at that time, and they sent me draft legislation to submit to Legislative Council to be consistent with legislation in California. They actually suggested that I introduce the initial bill that they had put in before it was amended. We got that back, and as time moved on, Florida also passed legislation. And what became clear, and the testimony that you heard last week, is the definitions of autonomous vehicle technology are changing. And that has led me to believe it is inappropriate to do all of what this bill does. I do not believe that definitions for technology or products belong in statute. That is because it's inflexible, it makes it difficult for us to be nimble, and it also puts at risk putting somebody's intellectual property into statute. I think that Oregon's interest in this technology should be not just the consumer end, but it should also be the innovation end. Who is that innovator that might be in a garage 3 blocks from here or 3 miles from here that may have that next vehicle that's ready to take out on the road? And I want to make sure that we have signaled that Oregon is ready for that. My proposal to you is that this bill be amended, that we retain the language that is in lines 2 through 19 of the bill that states Oregon's interest in autonomous technology, that kind of puts into statute that we are aware that this is there, and then we direct the department to look at this issue, to study this issue, and look at what we need to do to be ready to have these cars on the road, either as consumer vehicles or on a research basis. I think that I know that it could be possible for us to direct or ask the Department of Transportation to just do this, but I think it is important for us to make a statement in statute so that it's clear that the department has a legislative blessing to move forward, to act quickly as the technology changes quickly, so we can be responsive to researchers and to the market as it moves forward. Someone, and I no longer remember who, had made the comment that we don't need this because our current statute doesn't preclude autonomous vehicles or driverless vehicles on the road, and that's certainly true. But I do not believe that our statute ever contemplated this amazing technology. And I think it's important, even if it's just in a simple way, with a direction to the department and some values language, that we make that clear. Finally, I absolutely agree. We do not want to do anything in statute that gets in the way of innovation, that gets in the way of things moving quickly. And I want to be very responsive to that. But I also believe that as it relates to this exciting new technology, Oregon needs to be the master of her own destiny in determining when we are ready to have this technology. It is a decision for Oregon to make about when we are ready to talk about this. And I think the time is here, the time is now. It's a fun bill, and I look forward to working with you to amend it so that we can get it in our statute and show that Oregon is open for innovation and our roads are open to the newest technology that's possibly available to us. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative Gelser. One question I have. You mentioned some concepts that might be contained in amendments. Do you have amendments already? Are they forthcoming?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I wanted to wait until the hearing, until we could hear everyone that came forward, and I would be very responsive to suggestions that you all had. I know one of the key messages that I heard from the testimony and the comments from the dais on Monday was ensuring that study is not just about regulation, but also about innovation. What is the role
role in this for economic development, and how might we capitalize on this technology to build our economy and really support innovators? And I think that's an important element of the amendments, and I'm happy to accept any other recommendations. I'd like to work with you to get it right.
Very good. Thank you. Questions? Representative Lively.
So, and I really appreciate that. And so when you were talking about potential changes, so one of the things I heard in testimony before was kind of this five-year time frame about when maybe the technology in that might be more to the point, and I don't want to call it commercialization then. So I wonder, in relationship to your bill and what you're trying to accomplish, is there a horizon there that we want something back or some movement in that versus just a study?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lively, I've been thinking about that and trying to imagine how legislative council might word it. But I think that we certainly want a report back. I think it's time for the legislature to be engaged in this conversation moving forward. But we want to provide enough flexibility that the department knows we want them to be nimble, to be able to respond to things as quickly as they can and not have to wait for a legislative session.
Other questions? Thank you. We'll look forward to conversation about what the amendments might look like.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So we're continuing in public hearing here on House Bill 2428. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard on this bill now that we have it open again? I don't see anyone. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2428 and open a work session on House Bill 2107. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 2107. Remember, colleagues, this is the bill we heard some time ago around electronic proof of insurance. We have amendments, I believe. Actually, we will stand at ease again for a moment. Representative Davis, do you have the amendments? Do you want to explain them?
I think they're in the packet today. Yeah.
Very good. Do you want to explain them?
Would you like me to?
Sure. Great. Thanks.
The amendments, I think, were actually before this committee last time as well, but essentially allow a police officer who verifies that a person has insurance through their online computer system that shows up when they pull someone over and run their plates would not be required to issue that person a ticket, which apparently some jurisdictions are already doing. This just explicitly allows that in the statute and tells other jurisdictions that they're allowed to do that.
Very good. Thank you.
And to add on to that,
Representative Davis,
2 days after our initial hearing, I saw a TV commercial for some insurance company that's offering the cell phone proof of insurance. I thought that was interesting timing. I hadn't seen one of those before.
I believe it was targeted to you. Not everyone saw that one.
That's right.
Very good. So we have the Dash 1 amendments and all the necessary paperwork, says Troy. Representative Benz?
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2107.
Thank you. Representative Benz has moved the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2107. Is there any discussion? See any objections? I don't see any. The motion carries. The Dash 1 amendments are adopted. Representative Benz.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2107 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves House Bill 2107 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? See any. Is there any objection? I don't see any. The motion carries. House Bill 2107 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. It is in its original form Representative Garrett's bill. So given the work that you've done on it, Representative Davis, we might ask Representative Garrett if you and he might like to co-carry.
That sounds good. Yeah, I would like to touch base to make sure he's okay with that.
Very good.
But that sounds good for now. Yeah.
Very good. We will follow up if there's a reason to change that. But for now, Representative Davis and Representative Garrett co-carry. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2107 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3049. Troy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. House Bill 3049 permits Department of Transportation to issue veterans recognition registration plate to Gold Star family member who is a sibling or person who was killed in action in armed conflict while serving in armed forces of the United States.
Thank you. Representative Olson, thanks for your patience, and please begin and introduce your guests.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And committee members, my name is Andy Olson. I'm a state representative from the Albany area, and next door to me immediately here is Michael Thorpe, He's father of, if you remember a couple of weeks back, we introduced a bill where it put two roadside signs out on Highway 34 that recognized Army Specialist Eric McKinley from Philomath High School, and then also Lance Corporal Trevor Troyer, too, and Shorty. So we call you? This is Michael, Trevor's brother. So, okay, so this, you have testimony in front of me. I'm just going to go through this really quick with you. There was a bill that was introduced during the 07 session, and it was Senate Bill 557 from Senator Frank Morris and also at that time Senator Rick Metzger. And what it did at that time was it created the Gold Star plate, but it was specifically designed just for the spouse of the fallen member and also the family. It did not extend to the siblings. That's what this law does. That's how simple this is. And you can read, well, I mean, it's
very concise. Especially given some of the other things we've been taking on lately, we appreciate a simple and understandable.
Oh, do you want me to explain it a little more?
No. I was just appreciating the brevity of your testimony.
Thank you.
Yes. And we're happy to hear from
he's a simple man.
Go ahead, Michael.
Would you gentlemen like to offer some testimony?
Yes, I would.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, committee, my name is Michael Thorpe. I lost my son, Tyler, in 2005 in Iraq. In 2006, I contacted Senator Morse about doing a Gold Star license plate. Some friends of ours from Massachusetts already had one. I saw that, and it's like, nobody else. And it's one of those ideas that it's like, how come we don't have that here? So I worked with Senator Morse and drafted some legislation, a bill, to get a Gold Star license plate down here. At the time, there was about seven other states that had Gold Star license plates. There were several states that had it in the works. So I spent several hours trying to find what I could find on the internet for hearings, the language and stuff and how things were written. And of the other states that I found that had passed this, it was written, I wanted to have the best chances to have this succeed. So I wanted to adopt language that would measure up to what most people had gotten through and gotten past. So it's kind of my fault that, you know, the siblings don't get the license plate, because the way that most of the other states did it was that way. It was wives or children. But I've been hearing from my own kids, catching grief from my own kids, and having met other Gold Star families by attending funerals of other fallen here in Oregon, and seeing their children that are soon to grow up and get driver's license and own vehicles, it really started to make me think. And I enjoy my own plate, but when I look at it, on the very bottom it says, I don't know if he has a picture.
You do.
It says Gold Star family, not child or mom or father, family, and siblings are a very important part of that family. So that's why I spoke to Andy about, I definitely wanted to testify and admit that, you know, I was probably a little short-sighted on that. I probably should have done it and wrote it the way I wanted to do it and stood by myself, and if it sank, it sank, and if it went, it went. But I would really like you guys' support on just basically changing the language to allow whoever can get a Gold Star lapel pin, you know, be it the federal government. That's really all the change that really needs to be adopted to this, is that the same people that are legally all but can get a Gold Star lapel pin can also get this, apply for and get this Gold Star license plate too.
Thank you, Mr. Thorpe. Mr. Thorpe.
Thank you, Chairman, committee members. My name is Michael Samarn. My older brother was killed in action in 2005, November 19th. You know, as he stated, as soon as he put the bill up and it actually went through and passed, me and my sister were already jumping at him going, why weren't we involved in this? So,
Thanks, Dad.
You know, and we've kind of always felt a little bit left out when it comes to stuff like this, when it comes to the recognition of, you know, the siblings. The siblings usually just, I mean, it's almost like we don't matter. I know that it matters. Because, I mean, we hurt just as much as they did during that loss, because, you know, for me, I spent 14 years growing old with my growing up with my older brother, and you know, he was a big part of my life. And yet, you know, all I really want is just that little piece that shows how much, you know, he meant to me, and kind of even just a small thing of just having that plate, it just shows that, you know, I lost somebody who was willing to sacrifice for our country. And that's all I'm really asking is, you know, is to have that opportunity.
We appreciate your testimony. We appreciate the sacrifice and service of your family members. And I have to tell you, if we compiled a list of the number of times the legislature has to come back and correct something we didn't get quite right, it would be quite long. So you are not in a particularly exclusive club in saying we want to change something that we did before. And we appreciate you being here and making the case for it. Are there any questions? I don't see any.
I do have two other testimonies in writing. Read those into the record?
Well, if you have them in writing, we will make sure they get distributed to the committee. We're on a bit of a time crunch, so I think that would be better, but I promise we will read it and make sure it's distributed to the committee if that's okay with you. And it will, Troy reminds me, it will be part of the public record as well.
So they wanted to be here, but they couldn't, but I said email it to me and I'll get it to you guys.
We'll get it in the public record. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That completes the list of people who are signed up to testify on House Bill 3049. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard? See, so we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3049 and open a work session on House Bill 3049. Do we have all the paperwork we need, Troy?
I believe we do, Mr. Chairman. Yes, we do.
Very good. There is a subsequent.
Yeah.
Is that
why?
True?
It says, but why?
Yeah, that's right. What would it be?
Let's have a look at the bill. Well, no, the fiscal impact statement.
Minimal
revenue.
Minimal.
So I don't either.
Committee, I think we may be in that same situation we were the other day, where we might want to hold this and seek the rescission on the subsequent ways and means so that we can have a quicker path to passage. So just so you gentlemen understand that, we're not delaying. We want to make sure that it has a faster path. So after having just opened the work session, I'm going to close the work session, and we'll pursue the rescission of the Ways and Means subsequent, and we'll carry over the work session on House Bill 3049 so we can hopefully act on it next time. So close the work session on House Bill 3049. And that leaves us with House Bill 2298, so open the work session. Troy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 2298-2 directs the Oregon Business Development Department to establish bid process and bid pool to promote national and international sports events in Oregon, establishes Oregon Sports Event Bid Pool Fund, continuously appropriates money from general fund to department, and implementation of sports event bid process and bid pool.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, we have all the necessary paperwork, fiscal revenue, and -2 amendments.
Excellent. So we have -2 amendments. Drew, would you like to come up and help us understand the -2 amendments? Remember, committee, we heard some significant testimony about the potential of a bid pool and the events that might come our way. -2 amendments, I think, do a good job of advancing that concept. And Drew, if you'd like to explain some of the thinking behind
it. Sure. Drew Mihalik with the Oregon Sports Authority. Thank you, Chair Reed. Basically, the amendments attempt to address the comments made during the last testimony. And the key amendments attempt to make sure that there is a sense of statewide equity in the use of the funds, and that there is a process that is set out in section 4 that lists the matching funds that are necessary, the probability of success, its alignment with the tourism industry, to make sure that that there's a return on investment to make every attempt to bring in events that can replenish the bid fund, and the potential to have an event that affects more than one of the regions in Oregon, and to also include events that, that enhance the culture in terms of national and international visibility. And then there was comments that we should model the bill in with the same type of sentiment of Connect Oregon, and that has been addressed in trying to make sure that each of the regions, as defined by the state representatives, to make sure that they're all equally represented, and then each region would have to design their priority with what events would be the most important to them financially, in terms of economic return, culturally, and visibility. And I think that is the essence of addressing all your concerns that were really well pointed out.
Thank you. And if the committee decides to adopt the amendments and send the bill on, it clearly has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, which in this case, unlike the previous one, seems appropriate. Are there questions for Mr. Mihalik? Representative Benson.
Just one, Mr. Chair. I was just looking at the amendment and checking out the portion that talks about the report that BizOrg is to provide to the 2015 regular session, and the idea, of course, for me would be that it would show the things that are called out earlier.
Yes.
And the success or not of the investment. My question, I guess, is how will that information be gathered, and what would you be supplying to the department that we could anticipate seeing in 2015?
Well, Vice Chair Benson, Chair Reed, basically an evaluation needs to be done at the end of every event that's typically done to check the number of visitors that there have been to the area and the amount of money that they spent, and that way we know, you know, the value of that event economically and visibly. And so it will have to be that the Oregon Business Development Department receives the kind of information that went into the criteria for choosing that event, so that they know that their investment was worthwhile and meets the criteria for which it was selected. And our organization would certainly do everything we can to work with the Oregon Business Development Department to make sure that, that it is properly evaluated.
Thank you. To me, that's probably the most important thing that has to happen.
It may very well be.
Without adequate data.
Exactly.
If this passes, and if it makes us through Ways, I mean, all those ifs, it certainly wouldn't happen again without adequate data. So.
Agreed.
Okay. Thank you.
Good point. Thank you, Representative Benz. Other questions? Don't see any. If we're ready, then we have the dash 2 amendments. Representative Benz.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2298.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2298. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, motion carries. The amendments are adopted. Representative Benz.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2298 as amended to the floor of the do-pass recommendation with subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves House Bill 2298 as amended to the floor with the do-pass recommendation and subsequent referral to Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion? Representative Benz.
Just really, Mr. Chair, this is something that I thought long and hard about supporting or not. I've decided I will support it. It reminds me of many of the tax credit situations and other expenditures we've engaged in, and I'm willing to give it a try. I think it measures up, or has the possibility of measuring up well with some of the other things that we invest in, and so I'm willing to support it for these 2 years, and assuming Ways and Means does also,
right.
And we shall see.
Very good. Appreciate that. Thank you, Representative Benz. Any comments? Don't see any objections to the motion. See, the motion carries. House Bill 2298 goes to the floor with the due-pass recommendation and on to Ways and Means. Thank you very much. Close the work session on House Bill 2298. And one more to go. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2763. Troy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. House Bill 2763 establishes Oregon Task Force on Economic Development, sunsets task force on date of convening of 2015 regular session of Legislative Assembly, declares emergency effective on passage. And Mr. Chairman, we have all the required paperwork, including the Dash 1 amendments.
Thank you. We have Dash 1 amendments, as you say, and I'm stalling for a moment while Mr. Grove hopefully returns.
I'll go get him.
Thank you very much. The intent here, I think, is to take a pretty comprehensive look at some of the activities of the Business Development Department. I'll let him speak in more detail about that. He was just here a moment ago. So we'll stand at ease for a moment. Back to order. Paul, Mr. Saris, we've opened up House Bill 2763 and just very briefly introduced the Dash 1 amendments, but we appreciate your comments on them and how they might work.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul Grove with Business Oregon. My apologies for the delay. 2763, the Dash 1s, I believe, talk about the department engaging in a study regarding our business finance programs and, in particular, how they are meeting the needs of small businesses across the state. And as a department, we feel it's beneficial to continually evaluate these programs, what the needs are that exist across the state, and again, are we meeting those needs of small businesses, in particular around our direct loans, our loan guarantees, and the other programs within our portfolio. I want to point out one thing that I think this bill really builds off of that happened previously a couple years ago, or 18 months ago or so, around the partnership between the Oregon Community Foundation, Meyer Memorial Trust, the department, the treasurer's office, and others that resulted in a capital scan that identified business capital needs across the state and resulted in the formation passage of House Bill 4040 and the Oregon Growth Board and the recommendations that were presented before this committee about a month ago or 3 weeks ago. Assuming this bill were to move forward, we would like to engage or re-engage that public-private partnership to look at, again, the needs that exist across the state and how we can best meet those needs, in particular with our business finance programs.
Thank you. Mr. Saris, anything to add, or are you here simply to answer questions?
Chair Reed, members of the committee, absolutely here to answer any questions. And as Paul, really alluded to, it's a changing economy that we live in, and it's always great to be able to work with our partners, whether it's our lenders, economic development professionals, small businesses, to understand what their current needs are, see how the programs that we administer can continue to meet those needs and remain effective. So happy to answer any questions specific to the programs that we do administer, and
see what we can do to help the committee.
And I should have prompted you at the beginning, but if you wouldn't mind introducing yourself for the record, that would be great, too.
I apologize. Thank you, Chair. For the record, my name is John Saris, Business Services Manager at the Oregon Business Development Department, and I oversee the finance programs there.
Very much. Any questions for either of these gentlemen? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the obvious question is, haven't you been doing this as a matter of course in any event? Why the report? And is it one of those things that we need to prompt you to do it? Or is it, I need to know why this hasn't already been happening, because I recall in our past conversations over the past years, reports from the director regarding these programs, and no indication that anything was horribly wrong, or not. So share with us why this hasn't already been happening.
Chair Reed, Representative Vance, members of the committee, it's a very good point, and it is happening, and it continues to happen. I think to just have that certainty or that requirement to come back to the legislature and to continue to provide these updates as to what it is that we're doing, the committee could, you know, choose to have us do that as they see fit. But I think based on our experience in the capital scan and working with others, it proved to be very beneficial having these types of reports and presentations before the Legislative Assembly, not just on the value of our programs, but also one step further, the needs that exist across the state.
Follow up?
Yes, please.
I find it very interesting because we did have this conversation in discussing 4040 in some detail about the different types of structures we might use in managing these programs. And one of the issues that 4040 prompted, one of the discussions was a review by that organization of how we manage our borrowing or lending. And I thought that was a really good idea. Interested in knowing how you're going to go about this. It says a review of all the statutory laws governing business finance programs and then taking into account budgetary changes and needs from our small business. Fairly broad. And what will you do? How will you respond to this? Tell me what will happen is my question.
You can chime in a moment. Chair Reed, Representative Benz. I would envision, and this could be subject to change, a very similar process that we undertook previously with our public and private sector partners. For example, and this is something that the Growth Board has touched upon at its meetings, around microlending. We do administer microfinance program. That was identified in the glass capital scan as one of the gaps that exists in the state, not so much what's being provided at the state level, but what our private sector lenders are ultimately providing to these businesses. I would look at that discrete program within our department, partnering with the Growth Board and others like Mercy Corps, who have expressed interest, and others, to see how we can better address this need and use whatever findings may come out of that as a prospective recommendation to the committee and to the legislature.
And if I may add to that, sorry, Chair, Representative Benz, members of the committee, I think also, too, that even since that last capital scan that did occur about 18 months ago, things continue to change. And so we have been continuing to document opportunities to evaluate the programs and identify opportunities. This is a way for us to memorialize that and present it to the legislature for your review and see if there's an opportunity there. And maybe another example would be kind of an ongoing shift that we're seeing right now for financing that would help support businesses that do not have as many tangible assets. We have programs that are very heavily reliant upon fixed assets and the financing, and so many of these new industries that are cropping up and opportunities that are occurring here in this state right now may not be able to take advantage of that financing because of some of those limitations and restrictions. And if there are ways that we can address that, let's look at it and see how we can potentially continue to help.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. I just noticed that the fiscal impact statement is minimal, so confirming that you're essentially going to be using existing resources to do this.
Chair Reed, Representative Davis, yes.
Thank you.
Other questions? I don't see any. We've nearly cleared the room. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard on House Bill 2763? I don't see anyone, so we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2763 and open a work session on House Bill 2763. Representative Vince?
Chair, I move House Bill 2762. Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2763.
Thank you. Representative Benson moved the dash one amendments to House Bill 2763. Is there any discussion? Any objections? I don't see any. The motion is adopted. The amendments are in. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 2763 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation with subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
In fact, I made a mistake in not pointing out that given the amendment, we have received a notice from the Speaker's office that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means has been rescinded. So
we say my motion.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2763 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Benson has moved House Bill 2763 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, any objections? Seeing none, the motion carries. House Bill 2763 goes to the floor. I will be happy to carry it unless anyone else wants to. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2763. And unless there's anything else to come before the committee, I will restate that we have carried over House Bill 2067 and House Bill 3049 to our Friday meeting. And we're adjourned.
No, hold on, we haven't.
Did we do the national and international sporting?
We did. Yeah.
Representative Benz?
Mr. Chair, I move that rules be suspended to allow Representative Nathanson to vote on House Bill 2298.
Thank you. Representative Benz has moved that the rules be asked unanimous consent that the rules be suspended and Representative Nathanson be allowed to vote on House Bill 2298. Any objection? Seeing none, the rules are suspended. Representative Nathanson, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative Nathanson votes aye. Very good. Anything else? We're adjourned.
No,
we're not. We haven't dropped the gavel.
On the back.
It's okay.
Okay. Very good. Now we're adjourned. I've dropped the gavel. Yes?
I wanted to.